Greetings. We open chapter 16, The Integral Knowledge and the Aim of Life, Four Theories of Existence. This essay originally appeared in the Arya on 15 October 1918. It was called there, Four Theories of Existence. And there were no citations associated with it. We find here a set of citations from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the largest, the greatest in some estimations, from the Atharva Veda, the youngest of the four Vedas, and then from the Rig Veda, including one from the fourth book, which is one of the older books in the Rig Veda. It's interesting that he opens with the Brihadaranyaka, the great forest treatise. It was an Upanishad that was left largely untranslated by Sri Aurobindo. It's very vast. Sri Aurobindo worked primarily upon two in the pages of the Arya, as you know, the Isha, which is almost cognate with his idea of what is an integral reality of the divine, both that and this, the unmoving absolute and the manifest world and the individual working within the world. And the Kena has its own truths, but the Brihadaranyaka now suddenly appears as he's revising the life divine, and he puts it to good purpose here. Let's look at each of these citations. When all the desires, kama, that cling to the heart, hrde, are loosed away from it, then the mortal becomes immortal. Amrita. Even here, he possesses the eternal, Brahman. He backs up, then, to the end of the previous verse to underscore this stress on the eternal. He becomes the eternal and departs into the eternal. Brahmaiva san brahmapyeti. Then he comes back to that original verse, the seventh verse. This bodiless and immortal life and light, pranaha teja, is the Brahman. So we see him affirming that which is beyond the world, that which manifests itself in the world, our ability from within the world to gain access to that and realize it, and that that same thing is life and light above. There is one more citation from the Brihadaranyaka. This goes to the succeeding verse from the seventh. And by the way, the fourth book in this Upanishad largely deals with the great sage Yajñavalkya. Controversial, quizzical, incisive, ironic, world-embracing, world-transcending, all at once. Long and narrow is the ancient path. I have touched it, sprishtaha. I have found it, anuvittaha. The path, pantaha, by which the wise, dhira, steady in knowledge, knowers of the eternal, brahmaviddaha, attaining to salvation, vimuktaha, depart hence from here to the high world, swargalokam, of paradise. Now, this is a quotation. The Upanishad is quoting something that's even older than the Upanishad here. I have touched it. I have found it. Found the path. Found the reality. This is the voice of experience in this quoted verse. Brihadaranyaka also quotes from a more ancient wisdom when it says, Asato ma satkamaya. That whole verse is from a prior knowledge, from a wisdom that is anterior even to the Upanishads. So that's the set of citations from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the Great Forest Treatise Upanishad. This next pair comes from the Atharva Veda, late in the collection, in the 12th book. I am a son of earth, prithvi. The soil is my mother. May she lavish on me her manifold treasure, her secret riches. May we speak the beauty, charu, of thee, O earth, that is in thy villages and forests and assemblies and war and battles. Interesting, he translated this as war and battles. It might also mean hosts or gatherings, people coming together in collectivity. But note this, where the stress was on the eternal, found also here in the universe on the first group from the Upanishad, this is, I am a son of earth. Here, may we speak of your beauty, of your secret riches which are inside you, and find that beauty in the environment, literally the natural environment, in the villages, which is what we had then. We didn't have great cities yet in India. We had villages and the assemblies which constitute the collections of humanity, mirroring in human life what the cosmos says in the large. If we're an individual, then when we look for the first expansiveness, we find it in our human population, in our group. Then we come to know it as universal. We move from the near to the far. The next, may earth, sovereign over the past and the future, make for us a wide world. Earth that was the water, Salila, on the ocean, Arnava, and whose course the thinkers follow by the magic of their knowledge, Manishihi Maya. She who has her heart of immortality covered up by the truth in the supreme ether. May she establish for us light and power in that most high kingdom. By connotation, we can travel there and become one with that immortality which is above, concealed, hidden away in the supreme ether. But obviously, if we're going to get there, we have to do it from here, from where we are. Then there are a couple of citations from the Rig Veda. O flame, Agni, thou foundest the mortal in a supreme immortality, Amritatva Uttame. for increase of inspired knowledge day by day. For the seer, Rishi, who has thirst for the dual birth, Ubhayaya Janmane, thou createst divine bliss and human joy. This is interesting. Ubhayaya Janmane, dual birth. It means both births. The birth here in this world and the birth above. If you achieve that by growing daily, by drinking in the experience of life and finding the inspiration behind it, you reach both the divine bliss above and enjoy delight here in the human realm as well. Plenitude above, plenitude below. And then finally, another citation from the Rig Veda, and this is from the older part. O Godhead, this is also invoking Agni. O Godhead, guard for us the infinite and lavish the finite. Guard for us, Urushya, the infinite, Aditi, and lavish the finite, Diti. So keep us in the consciousness of what is beyond all, what is immeasurable. But let us enjoy this too. So that same God that takes us above, that unites the thread of our being here with that tapestry of existence above, gives both the final delight above, but the here and now riches available to us on earth. So here he'll talk about the four theories of existence regarded in the aim of life. And the first, of course, will be the theory that regards what is beyond the cosmos, what he would call the supracosmic. One that regards the terrestrial view, that this world here is what is real and is the aim of our life. Another which carries us beyond this world, above into an otherworldly state, and finally, a perspective which will be integral. This will be the course of events. Let's begin. But before we examine the principles and process of the evolutionary ascent of consciousness, it is necessary to restate what our theory of integral knowledge affirms as fundamental truths of the reality and its manifestation, and what it admits as effectual sides and dynamic aspects, but is unable to accept as sufficient for a total explanation of existence and the universe. For truth of knowledge must base truth of life and determine the aim of life. The evolutionary process itself is the development of a truth of existence concealed here in an original inconscience and brought out from it by an emerging consciousness which rises from gradation to gradation of itself unfolding until it can manifest in itself the integral reality of things and a total self-knowledge. On the nature of that truth from which it starts and which it has to manifest must depend the course of the evolutionary development, the steps of its process, and their significance. First, we affirm an absolute as the origin and support and secret reality of all things. The absolute reality is indefinable and ineffable by mental thought and mental language. It is, self-existent and self-evident to itself, as all absolutes are self-evident, but our mental affirmatives and negatives, whether taken separatively or together, cannot limit or define it. But at the same time, there is a spiritual consciousness, a spiritual knowledge, a knowledge by identity, which can seize the reality in its fundamental aspects and its manifested powers and figures. All that is comes within this description, and if seen by this knowledge in its own truth or its occult meaning, can be regarded as an expression of the reality and itself a reality. So there's an absolute, unattainable by mind, beyond its comprehension, but which is seizable by a spiritual knowledge by identity. And that which it knows is real. It can grasp fundamental aspects. It can have a true knowledge. All that comes from that absolute is accessible to, apprehendable to, this spiritual consciousness. This manifested reality is self-existent in these fundamental aspects. For all the basic realities are a bringing out of something that is eternal and inherently true in the absolute. But all that is not fundamental, all that is temporary, is phenomenal, is form and power, dependent on the reality it expresses, and is real by that and by its own truth of significance, the truth of what it carries in it, because it is that and not something fortuitous, not baseless, illusory, a vain constructed figure. So all the aspects that emerge from it have a reality because that reality is there sustaining them. They don't in and of themselves have that force of reality. It is a derived dependent reality. He continues, even what deforms and disguises, as falsehood deforms and disguises truth, evil deforms and disguises good, has a temporal reality as true consequences of the inconscience. But these contrary figures, though real in their own field, are not essential, but only contributory to the manifestation and serve it as a temporal form or power of its movement. This has been core to his argument about how evil and falsehood arise from the inconscient. They can do that as part of the forms and processes of a dependent, suppressed force of being. They are not essential. They are not cognate with the absolute. The universal, then, is real by virtue of the absolute of which it is a self-manifestation, and all that it contains is real by virtue of the universal to which it gives a form and figure. So you see this chain of being. There's an absolute which manifests itself as the universal. The things that arise within the universal have a reality true to the universal manifestation. The fundamental aspects of the universal are drawn from the absolute, but not everything that's in the universal draws its force of being from the absolute. Many of the forces, forms, processes, phenomena are drawn from the universal base itself, from that matrix, and so are distinguishable from the absolute. Thus, evil and falsehood do not arise from the absolute, but from this dependent reality, the suppressed reality, which is the manifestation as in a way, embedded in the unconscious. So, he continues, the absolute manifests itself in two terms, a being and a becoming. The being is the fundamental reality. The becoming is an effectual reality. It is a dynamic power and result, a creative energy and working out of the being, a constantly persistent yet mutable form, process, outcome of its immutable, formless essence. All theories that make the becoming sufficient to itself are therefore half-truths, valid for some knowledge of the manifestation acquired by an exclusive concentration upon what they affirm and envisage, but otherwise valid only because the being is not separate from the becoming, but present in it, constitutive of it, inherent in its every infinitesimal atom and in its boundless expansion and extension. Becoming can only know itself wholly when it knows itself as being. The soul in the becoming arrives at self-knowledge and immortality when it knows the supreme and absolute and possesses the nature of the infinite and eternal. Back to the citations earlier. To do that is the supreme aim of our existence. What was that supreme aim? The soul in the becoming arrives at self-knowledge and immortality when it knows the supreme and absolute and possesses the nature of the infinite and eternal. That does not say that this soul in the becoming leaves the becoming. It says that it arrives at the nature of the infinite and the absolute and eternal and possesses that. To do that is the supreme aim of our existence, for that is the truth of our being and must therefore be the inherent aim, the necessary outcome of our becoming. This truth of our being becomes in the soul a necessity of manifestation. In matter, a secret energy. In life, an urge and tendency, a desire and a seeking. In mind, a will, aim, endeavor, purpose. To manifest what is from the first occult within it is the whole hidden trend of evolutionary nature. These secret riches that are embedded within us in seemingly divided, limited, finite nature, if discovered, if found to be extensions of the essence of being, can lead us through an evolutionary ascent back to the truth of our ultimate self, being, nature. Therefore, he writes, we accept the truth on which the philosophies of the supracosmic absolute take their stand. Illusionism itself, even if we contest its ultimate conclusions, can still be accepted as the way in which the soul in mind, the mental being, has to see things in a spiritual, pragmatic experience, which it cuts itself off from the becoming in order to approach and enter into the absolute. So there's an absolute above, supracosmic, beyond the universe, before the manifestation. We accept that. Illusionism, which says the universe is unreal, we can accept provisionally, because the soul and the mind, the mental being, can use it as a way of cutting itself off from gross identification with form and phenomena, and find the spiritual truth behind, get back to the absolute. But it's provisional. It's not the last view, but it is a liberating view, because we get liberated from engrossment into nature so that we have forgotten the spirit. We need to remember and recall and recover our spiritual essence. And if for the moment we have to depend upon illusionism to divorce us from attachment to the outer form, well and good, we have to do it. It's justified so far as it goes, but we can outgrow it. And he continues now. But also, since the becoming is real and is inevitable in the very self-power of the infinite and eternal, this too is not a complete philosophy of existence. It is possible for the soul in the becoming to know itself as the being and possess the becoming, to know itself as infinite in essence, but also as the infinite self-expressed in the finite, the timeless eternal, regarding itself and its works in the founding status and the developing motion of time eternity. And this is exactly what was accomplished in the personage of Yajñavalkya, who was speaking to us in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, cited earlier. This realization is the culmination of the becoming. It is the fulfillment of the being in its dynamic reality. This too then must be part of the total truth of things, for it alone gives a full spiritual significance to the universe and justifies the soul in manifestation. An explanation of things that deprives cosmic and individual existence of all significance cannot be the whole explanation or the solution it proposes, the sole true issue. So we're grateful for illusionism, for the initial liberation it gives, but we don't accept it as an all-sufficing explanation of the nature of existence or of the nature of the universe. So his first affirmation was that the absolute is. From the absolute come being and becoming. Being the essence, the becoming, the mobile manifestation of that essence and all that comes from it. And that absolute is the secret nature of all. The next affirmation which we put forward is that the fundamental reality of the absolute is to our spiritual perception a divine existence, consciousness, and delight of being, which is a supracosmic reality, self-existent, but also the secret truth underlying the whole manifestation. For the fundamental truth of being must necessarily be the fundamental truth of becoming. This is again the concept of Satchit Ananda, which you know well by now. All is a manifestation of that, for it dwells even in all that seem to be its opposites, and its hidden compulsion on them to disclose it is the cause of evolution. On inconscience, to develop from itself its secret consciousness, on the apparent non-being, to reveal in itself the occult spiritual existence, on the insensible neutrality of matter, to develop a various delight of being which must grow, setting itself free from its minor terms, its contrary dualities of pain and pleasure, into the essential delight of existence, the spiritual ananda. That is worth marking on your pages. Don't lose that passage. Read it from time to time. The being is one. But this oneness is infinite and contains in itself an infinite plurality or multiplicity of itself. The one is the all. It is not only an essential existence, but an all existence. The infinite multiplicity of the one and the eternal unity of the many are the two realities or aspects of one reality on which the manifestation is founded. By reason of this fundamental verity of the manifestation, the being presents itself to our cosmic experience in three poises: the supracosmic existence, the cosmic spirit, and the individual self in the many. He's expressed this earlier as the transcendent, the universal, and the individual. So a being which is one and yet multiple, an essential existence and all existence. Oneness and multiplicity are aspects of its single reality. And it is above the universe. It is within and is the universe, and it is the very self of each in the many. But the multiplicity permits of a phenomenal division of consciousness, an effectual ignorance in which the many, the individuals, cease to become aware of the eternal self-existent oneness and are oblivious of the oneness of the cosmic self in which and by which they live, move, and have their being. But by force of the secret unity, the soul in becoming is urged by its own unseen reality and by the occult pressure of evolutionary nature to come out of this state of ignorance and recover eventually the knowledge of the one divine being and its oneness with it, and at the same time to recover its spiritual unity with all individual beings and the whole universe. So, pardon me, it has to become aware not only of itself in the universe, but of the universe in itself, and of the being of cosmos as its greater self. The individual has to universalize himself, and in the same movement to become aware of his supracosmic transcendence. This triple aspect of the reality must be included in the total truth of the soul and of the cosmic manifestation. And this necessity must determine the ultimate trend of the process of evolutionary nature. So the force in our soul, aided by the pressure of evolutionary nature, forces us to grow until we can discover our own truth in psychic principle and our oneness with the cosmos around and beyond that universality to live in the supracosmic, that thing which is above. So if we don't have all of these aspects of our nature absorbed within our self-realization, if these all don't become part of what we are doing, then our work is incomplete. We have still farther to grow, more to incorporate, more to integrate. He continues, all views of existence that stop short of the transcendence and ignore it must be incomplete accounts of the truth of being. The pantheistic view, that's that Godhead is everywhere in the universe, and basically that's where it is. The pantheistic view of the identity of the divine in the universe is the truth. For all this that is the Brahman. But it stops short of the whole truth when it misses and omits the supracosmic reality. Because in our integrated view, this manifestation is drawn from that. All divinity is not restricted to the universal manifestation. There is that which is unexpressed, which is above. That is full, this is full. Purnam madaha, purnam idam. On the other side, every view that affirms the cosmos only and dismisses the individual as a byproduct of the cosmic energy errs by laying too much emphasis on one apparent factual aspect of the world action. It is true only of the natural individual and is not even the whole truth of that. In other words, if you look at the individual as being only this name and form before you, then yes, that's dissolvable, that disappears. But there is an inner truth, an immortal truth behind the presence of the individual in the cosmos, which ought not to be dismissed. So if you affirm only cosmos, you've missed something by refusing to see the supracosmic beyond. If you affirm only the cosmos and dismiss the individual, you miss that side too. So we're beginning to see that all three are necessary, no? For the natural individual, the nature being, is indeed a product of the universal energy, but is, at the same time, a nature personality of the soul, an expressive formation of the inner being and person. And this soul is not a perishable cell or a dissoluble portion of the cosmic spirit, but has its original immortal reality in the transcendence. It is a fact that the cosmic being expresses itself through the individual being, but also it is the truth that the transcendental reality expresses itself through both the individual existence and the cosmos. The soul is an eternal portion of the supreme and not a fraction of nature. But equally, any view that sees the universe as existent only in the individual consciousness must very evidently be a fragmentary truth. It is justified by a perception of the universality of the spiritual individual and his power of embracing the whole universe in his consciousness, but neither the cosmos nor the individual consciousness is the fundamental truth of existence. For both depend upon and exist by the transcendental divine being. Hence, our first affirmation, the absolute from which being and becoming come, from which cosmos and individual emanate. So, that being comes into focus next. This divine being, Satchit Ananda, is at once impersonal and personal. It is an existence and the origin and foundation of all truths, forces, powers, existences. But it is also the one transcendent conscious being and the all person of whom all conscious beings are the selves and personalities. For he is their highest self and the universal indwelling presence. It is a necessity for the soul in the universe, and therefore the inner trend of the evolutionary energy and its ultimate intention. To know and to grow into this truth of itself, to become one with the divine being, to raise its nature to the divine nature, its existence into the divine existence, its consciousness into the divine consciousness, its delight of being into the divine delight of being, and to receive all this into its becoming, to make the becoming an expression of that highest truth, to be possessed inwardly of the divine self and master of its existence, and to be at the same time wholly possessed by him and moved by his divine energy, and live and act in a complete self-giving and surrender. On this side, the dualistic and theistic views of existence, which affirm the eternal real existence of God and the soul, and the eternal real existence and cosmic action of the divine energy, express also a truth of the integral existence. But their formulation falls short of the whole truth if it denies the essential unity of God and soul, or their capacity for utter oneness, or ignores what underlies the supreme experience of the merger of the soul in the divine unity through love, through union of consciousness, through fusion of existence in existence. I submit to you that's a perfect place to pause in the reading this evening. We'll add some lines from Savitri. These are from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. Canto 6. Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. This knowledge in our hidden parts we keep, awake to a vague mystery's appeal. We meet a deep unseen reality, far truer than the world's face of present truth. We are chased by a self we cannot now recall, and moved by a spirit we must still become. As one who has lost the kingdom of his soul, we look back to some God phase of our birth, other than this imperfect creature here, and hope in this or a diviner world to recover yet from heaven's patient guard what by our mind's forgetfulness we miss, our being's natural felicity, our heart's delight we have exchanged for grief, the body's thrill we bartered for mere pain, the bliss for which our mortal nature yearns, as yearns an obscure moth to blazing light. Our life is a march to a victory never won. This wave of being longing for delight, this eager turmoil of unsatisfied strengths, these long, far files of forward-striving hopes, lift worshiping eyes to the blue void called heaven, looking for the golden hand that never came, the advent for which all creation waits, the beautiful visage of eternity that shall appear upon the roads of time. Yet still to ourselves we say, rekindling faith, oh, surely one day he shall come to our cry, one day he shall create our life anew, and utter the magic formula of peace, and bring perfection to the scheme of things. One day he shall descend to life and earth, leaving the secrecy of the eternal doors into a world that cries to him for help, and bring the truth that sets the spirit free, the joy that is the baptism of the soul, the strength that is the outstretched arm of love. One day he shall lift his beauty's dreadful veil, impose delight on the world's beating heart, and bear his secret body of light and bliss. But now we strain to reach an unknown goal. There is no end of seeking and of birth. There is no end of dying and return. The life that wins its aim asks greater aims. The life that fails and dies must live again. Till it has found itself, it cannot cease. All must be done for which life and death were made. But who shall say that even then is rest? Or there repose and action are the same in the deep breast of God's supreme delight? In a high state where ignorance is no more, each movement is a wave of peace and bliss. Repose, God's motionless creative force. Action, a ripple in the infinite, and birth, a gesture of eternity. A sun of transfiguration still can shine, and night can bear its core of mystic light. The self-canceling, self-afflicting paradox into a self-luminous mystery might change, the imbroglio into a joyful miracle. Then God could be visible here. Here take a shape. Disclosed would be the spirit's identity. Life would reveal her true immortal face. But now, a termless labor is her fate. In its recurrent decimal of events, birth, death, are a ceaseless iteration's points. The old question mark margins each finished page, each volume of her effort's history. A limping yes through the eons journeys still, accompanied by an eternal no. All seems in vain, yet endless is the game. Impassive turns the ever-circling wheel. Life has no issue, death brings no release. A prisoner of itself, the being lives and keeps its futile immortality. Extinction is denied, its soul escape. An error of the gods has made the world, or indifferent the eternal watches time. End of Canto 6. Well, he teases you with some ironic jests at the end. Remember that line above. Then God could be visible here. Here, take a shape. Disclosed would be the spirit's identity. Life would reveal her true immortal face. So, a creative pause until we meet again. Namaste. Jai Ma.